The Company, April 1903.
"So, this is your boy," Uncle Brightstar said.
"Yes, Uncle," Father pushed me forward. Uncle studied me as he would a new flat iron looking for flaws. I stared back at him. They don't make men like Uncle Brightstar anymore. His hands were calloused by mining the California streams for gold, and his left index finger was twisted slightly from an accident when he had been helping to dig tunnels through the mountains for the railroad. Uncle had few classmates left. Classmates was the term which one government official might use for another official who had passed the government exams in the same year as he. But Uncle liked to say that the demons had examined him more rigorously than any government exam. He was in his 80s, and short and fat and built like a rock. He had a round face, with broad cheeks and a weak chin that made his thick lips seem to protrude even more. His belly stuck out above his pants top. It was usually covered by the loose tunic all the Tong men wore, but today he had worn a special blue silk coat.
"Don't you know it's impolite to stare, boy?" Uncle grunted.
"Why are you doing it then, sir?"
He rapped my forehead with his knuckle. "This boy has character, at least."
Everyone laughed, relieved. I had been accepted. Uncle turned to Father.
"You're a lucky man, Windrider."
"Windrider?" I asked Father. "That's not your name."
"It is now," Father said. "I'll explain later."
It was a good thing that my father was with me. The thousands of miles I had crossed were nothing compared to the last mile or so between the docks and the town of the Tong people, Chinatown. I kept twisting my head this way and that to look at the hills until Father stopped.
"What's the matter?" he asked.
"Which one is the Golden Mountain?" Father did not even look at me, but turned around to look at poor Handclap.
"Those 2 years in the Middle Kingdom haven't changed you one bit."
"Oh, now,"
Handclap mumbled. He scratched his neck in embarrassment.
"After all, the truth's what you make it."
Uncle Brightstar snorted.
"It's a good thing you don't keep the books."
Father clapped his hand on my shoulder.
"Boy, you have to realize that there was never a flea that Handclap didn't call a horse, and there was never a horse that he didn't call an elephant.
And there has never been a country big enough to hold the elephant that Handclap has seen."
Lefty laughed. He was bent almost double, hefting my straw chest with his good hand as it rested on his back.
"You mean there's no Golden Mountain?"
I was disappointed and felt a little betrayed.
"Not that we've ever seen,"
Uncle Brightstar added more kindly.
"Though we've often wished it."
"Oh," I said in a very small voice. Father took my hand kindly.
"But there's a lot left to the demon's land that we haven't seen. Maybe we'll run across it yet." "And like I've always said, that will be the day that everyone in the world decides to use copper and not gold for money," Uncle said.
"Then we'll look for a mountain of copper," Father laughed.
"And we'll let Handclap be our guide," added White Deer.
"And I'll guide you, cousins, straight and true," said Handclap. "For there's nothing I can't do. I can dig up a mountain, drink up a lake, outrun the wind."
Handclap rambled on. Father took the opportunity to whisper to me,
"Stick close to me, Moonshadow, and don't be afraid."
To get to the Tong people's town, you see, we had to pass through the Barbary Coast, a place filled with brothels and saloons and gambling joints. Walking up the street, I nearly lost heart. To me, the wooden houses seemed like shells of wood which terrible monsters had spun about themselves. It seemed as if the monsters would break out any moment through the wooden walls and grab me. One demon building in particular was very bad. It was only a saloon, I learned later, but it seemed terrible to me. It reeked of vomit and cheap liquor and stale sweat. For a long time I would associate this smell with the homes of the demons.
A young white demon pushed through its doors. He was in strange clothes of black and white that were obviously dress-up. I wondered if he were some kind of special demon. I watched as he stumbled into the railing before the saloon and quietly sat down. His eyes crossed.
"What are you looking at, you little—"
It sounded like
"China man."
I looked at Father for a translation, but he had grown angry. Uncle Brightstar stepped in between us and bowed.
"No sabe, no sabe. So sorry."
And the others gathered around us and began pushing us up the steep hill toward the safety of the town of the Tong people. Suddenly, I felt as if I had come home. I can see the town of the Tong people even now in the late afternoon sun. Not as it is now, full of souvenir shops and neon signs, but as it was then. The houses and the stores had all the right colors and shapes, for they had been built not by demons, but by the Tong people. It looked much like the streets in Canton, the city in the Middle Kingdom from which I had sailed. The roofs of the buildings here were tiled and arched, and the walls, windows, and doorways were in gold or red or green. Before the fronts of the buildings were sensible safeguards against demons of any kind. There were lions lying down protectively before some. Other houses had pictures of the door guardians on their doors, and still others had scrolls of red paper on the doorways, asking a certain god to protect the inhabitants against demons. On the blank walls of some buildings were long, narrow strips of red paper upon which words had been painted in thick black ink. My father told me that some of them were advertisements offering a heavy winter coat for sale or somebody's services in writing a letter home or perhaps a request to buy a demon watch. Above the posters and storefronts were balconies upon which men lounged, their faces turned toward the sun and their shadows arching behind them on the walls like long tails. There was a breeze blowing down the hill, and the men had gathered outside, standing on the sidewalks, their hands behind their backs, talking amiably. In their dark tunics and pants, they looked like shadows, a street of shadows, flitting here and there, talking in high, loud, excited voices. People who think the Tong people are quiet have never listened to us in our own homes, where the conversation is carried on at the level of a shout. And from some room far above the street came the lonely, peaceful sound of a moon guitar. The streets were narrow, and the tall three-story buildings on either side made them seem even narrower. Vendors shuffled along in the dusty streets because the sidewalks were too crowded. Over their shoulders, the vendors had heavy poles, from which they balanced baskets at either end, some with vegetables, others with pastries or candies or toys. Their loads seemed heavy enough until the demon wagons rolled toward them, pulled by the huge-bodied demon horses with their breaths blowing and the sweat glistening on their flanks. Then the vendors had to dodge nimbly to avoid being trampled under the heavy hooves, while the demon drivers shouted largely unintelligible curses at them. There were groceries and herbal shops, clothing shops and laundries, halls that housed the brotherhoods or the district associations or the offices of family clans. Uncle pointed out the building of the district from which my family came and to which I could go for help. Besides that, there was the Lee family building, which would help everyone who was named Lee. But most interesting to me were the men who sold their products from the stalls on the street. There was a butcher who worked in the mouth of a narrow alley. Behind the butcher were cages with fresh chickens waiting to be killed for the buyer, and before him was a big zinc wash basin filled with fresh fish. In one cage by his feet was a wildcat, for some man who wanted to regain some of his youthful vigor. There were men in long, narrow stalls set against the sides of buildings who sold toys and different candies, one a type of sweet but hot-tasting candied ginger that was a bright orange-red in color. There were dried fruits that you could buy, sweet, semi-sweet, or salty. These you sucked inside your mouth till all the flavor was gone, then you stripped the moistened meat away from the seed. There were apricot candies pressed flat into wafers, thin white curled strips of coconut candy, several kinds of disc-like rice cookies, and so on. And in the doorways, men sat on the stoops selling various newspapers gathered in piles around them. I should say now that there were no women on the streets, only men. Thousands of men. And perhaps carefully locked away in the buildings might be a few hundred Tong women. Most of the women who came to the Demon Land were prostitutes. Oh, there were a few rich merchants who had brought their wives over with their maids, but these were the exceptions, and the wives had to be locked up even more carefully than the prostitutes to keep them from being kidnapped by some brotherhood and put to work in a brothel in another city. We stopped before a small, neat, three-story building painted bright red and green. On the front of the building was a huge sign on which were painted Tong people's symbols and demon words, announcing to the whole wide world that this was the Company of the Peach Orchard Vow. The demons always thought the name was funny. Uncle let them laugh. It was Uncle who told me that the Peach Orchard Vow was a famous vow taken by the man who became the god of war and his two sworn brothers to serve the people and help one another. On the door were painted the names of two door guardians who kept the demons away, and on the windows were painted the words for long life and prosperity. With a flourish, Uncle opened the front door for me and ushered me inside.
"A superior home for superior men," he said.
Uncle was fond of the phrase, "the superior man," which he said he had taken from the wise man Confucius. I stepped in and looked around. The air smelled of soap and food and sweat. The bottom floor was given over to the laundry. The washing was done in the basement and in the back half of the first floor. A long curtain shut the back half off from view. In the front half, the half where I was now, there was a circular stove with a broad rack on top that stood in the middle of the floor. Spare flat irons heated up on the rack. When a man's iron cooled, he took another from the rack and put the cold one back on the rack to reheat. On the walls to either side of the stove and within reaching distance were ironing boards that folded down from the wall itself. On the walls above the ironing boards were strips of thick, bright red paper with poems and sayings on them. Since the words of the Tong people were more alive, more like pictures, really, handwriting was more of an art form than among demons. All the poems and the sayings were done in lively or lovely hands. The most delicately written poem had been done by Lefty, when he still had his right hand. It was a poem written by the drunken genius, Li the White, who drowned one night when he tried to embrace the moon as it appeared on the lake. The poem went like this. Upon my bed lies the bright moonlight, like frost upon the earth. Lifting my eyes, I see the bright moon. Closing my eyes, I see home. The poem hung above Lefty's ironing board. There were other, more conventional pious sayings up on the walls, ones like peace and prosperity upon this door. They had been written by a man who had belonged to the company before us. And there was one strip, faded and smoke-smudged by time, which had been written by one of the men who had founded the company and who was long since dead. The founder had written, "The three virtues of the stranger are to be silent, to be cunning, but above all, to be invisible." Uncle told me that the warning had been taken from one of the Middle Kingdom's oldest books, Classic of Changes. All of us went up the stairs to the second floor. This was used as a kitchen and relaxation room, where the company could read or gossip or play mahjong, the game with tiles that is something like the demon's card game of gin rummy. On the third floor were our sleeping quarters. The dinner we had that night was the finest I ever had. White Deer was the cook. He was a devout Buddhist who ate no meat and so few vegetables that I doubt if a grasshopper could have lived on what he ate. Still, he was one of the finest cooks around. At 60, White Deer was the second oldest in the company. Technically speaking, White Deer, Uncle, and Handclap were all partners. Handclap had originally sold his share of the laundry to the other two when he had returned to the Middle Kingdom. But now that he had come back to the land of the Golden Mountain, he had bought back his share. Lefty, Black Dog, Uncle's son, Father, and I only worked for wages till the day we could buy a junior partnership. But White Deer and Handclap never lorded it over any of us. We were all equally under Uncle's orders. At any rate, White Deer outdid himself that day. He made duck with the skin parted and crisped, and the meat salty and rich and good. He had cooked squab in soy sauce so that the skin and meat were a deep, deep brown all the way to the bone. There was shark's fin soup, tasting of the sea. There were huge prawns fried in a special batter that gave them an extra fluffy coat, and on and on. But we weren't allowed to touch any of the courses until we had the toasts. Lefty raised a cup of wine in his left hand. His right arm he held behind his back, as he often did. Handclap had warned me beforehand not to stare. Like many another lonely man, Lefty had taken up gambling the way others might have taken up drinking or dope. It was something to fill in the long, empty hours. As Handclap had told me, Lefty bought his ticket home, but the night before he was to leave, he tried to double his money. Not only did he lose all his money, but his ticket home as well. In despair, the next morning, because he would not see his family for at least another 5 years, he had taken a cleaver and cut off his right hand, the hand that held the dice. Lefty came from Canton, so he spoke a different dialect from ours. There was a kind of polish on Lefty, which is perhaps why he was picked to give the toast. Lefty held up his cup of wine. The wines of the Tong people are of a very high alcoholic content and much stronger than demon wines. In fact, the 60-proof demon brandy was what Uncle called wine. "A toast," Lefty said, "to our youngest brother, Moonshadow, the son of the brilliant Windrider. May Moonshadow work hard. May he become rich soon. May he return home even sooner." Everyone drank to that. Uncle tossed his drink back in one gulp.
"Dry cup,"
he announced, and turned his cup upside down. Not one drop was left inside to fall down. He smacked his lips.
"My, my, but that is a righteous wine. I'll have another."
When Uncle's second cup had been poured, he looked at me.
"Boy, this company was here a year before I even came to the land of the demons, and it was operating successfully for 20 years before I finally joined it. It will go on after me, for this company is an idea. It is a dream. A dream that is much older than you or I, and only slightly younger than the world. Men must help one another in dangerous times and places."
"Yes, now to the company," Handclap said.
We all drank again.
Again, Uncle shouted, "Dry cup,"
and held his cup upside down. White Deer dumped a big spoonful of rice into Uncle's bowl.
"Here, old man, better get something in that stomach of yours before you get sick."
If Uncle Brightstar was the father to us, White Deer was something like a mother. We all set to eating then. The talk around the table was about our villages and events in the Middle Kingdom, especially now that the Boxer Rebellion was over for good. But eventually, things came around to what Handclap had missed in the demon's land. It turned out that the mad socialist, Theodore Roosevelt, was going to run for re-election. He had been vice president at the time when the real president, McKinley, had been shot in a provincial city. It was the only way, Uncle solemnly declared, that the crazy demon could have gotten into office. To Uncle's mind, Roosevelt was always trying to wreck the big companies. Uncle was against any tampering with business, even those belonging to demons. Finally, when everyone had eaten his fill and could not touch another morsel, Uncle announced it was time for the presents. Lefty and White Deer went upstairs. When they came back down, they told me not to look behind me.
"Our young man must be properly attired."
Lefty jammed a black hat down over my eyes.
"That should keep the sun off that girlish skin of yours."
I pulled up the brim and took it off and looked at it, smoothing the crown. "Thanks," I said. "But are you sure you won't be needing it to keep the sun off that nose of yours?" The company all laughed uproariously at that. Even Lefty good-naturedly rubbed his nose.
"Well, I might just take it back, boy, to hang it on my nose, so best keep an eye on it."
White Deer put a tunic and trousers on the table. "These are from me," White Deer said. "I hope they fit."
"If not, we'll cut him to fit the clothes," Father said. "And these are from me to keep those calloused farmers' feet of yours from wearing out the demon's streets."
Uncle Brightstar clomped a pair of boots onto the table.
"Actually, you're to wear these only when the rain comes, so don't waste the leather in the dry times."
Uncle sat back, satisfied, as I admired the shiny black leather.
"Now, let's see what the Windrider has for his son."
Father spread his hands on the table.
"I don't have anything nearly as fine as these things," he said. "Why, the Emperor himself would be proud to clothe his son in such fine raiment."
"Well, the Emperor's son will just have to go naked,"
Handclap shouted, and they laughed and hooted at that, for there was no love lost for the present Emperor, who was a Manchu, a son of the foreigners who had conquered the Middle Kingdom and who long ago made us wear queues as a sign that we had been beaten by them. The queues were supposed to imitate the tails of horses, as if we were animals who had been tamed. It was death for any Tong man to wear his hair short. Of course, over a period of 260 years, a lot of Tong men no longer knew what the queue had originally symbolized. They could be quite vain about the care of their queues, but that did not mean they loved the Manchus.
"Go on. Fetch your silly toy."
Uncle jerked his head at the stairs. With a secret smile, Father disappeared up the stairs. I heard his boots mount the steps heavily. He came down the steps a moment later from his third-floor room. Under his arm, he had a kite. But what a kite! The frame of light bamboo sticks had been bent, tied, and glued into the shape of a butterfly. And then the frame had been covered with rice paper, which is a thin, translucent kind of paper. The paper had been painted in bright blue and green colors. It seemed to tremble in Father's hands. I could see the jets of the gaslights through the tissue-thin paper. The kite seemed to glow and vibrate as if it were alive and breathing in my father's hands. I knew it would fly well when I tried it.
"It's just a little something," Father said casually.
"Be careful with it," Uncle warned.
But I did not need to be told that. I would sooner have broken my arm. Arms can heal, but not wings like these.
"What do you say, boy?"
Uncle poked me in the ribs. "Thank you, Father," I said. I wanted to tell him about all the marvelous times I had had flying his kites, but I did not know how. Father rumpled my hair affectionately.
"You're welcome, boy. They gave you things for your body. I gave you something for your soul."
At that moment, the bell rang as someone came through the front door. We heard heavy boots come up the stairs. Everyone grew silent in the room. I knew it was Black Dog coming. Black Dog was the son born of Uncle's second wife. Uncle had taken more than one wife, as was the custom. Black Dog was a strange, brooding man in his 40s. Thanks to Uncle's hard work, Black Dog and his brothers and sisters had been raised in luxury back in the Middle Kingdom. He had resented it when his father had made him come to the land of the Golden Mountain. All of a sudden, after living like a young lord, he found himself doing the most drudge-like work. It had not helped matters that he had come during the time of the Troubles, when the demons had roared through the Tong people's town, claiming the Tong people took jobs away from them. They beat up innocent Tong men and hung others by their queues from the lampposts. Black Dog began to despise his own father. He began to hang out with the brotherhoods who ran the gambling and the prostitution and the drug trade in the Tong people's town, and who were constantly fighting each other over control of various shady activities. Finally, Black Dog had taken to opium. He worked during the day in an offhand, insolent manner, but there was a strangeness to his eyes whenever you spoke to him. Now he stood in the doorway, his hands stuffed into his pockets beneath his huge jacket. He was as tall as Father, but paler, and there was a scar by his right temple that he had gotten in a sword fight.
"Where were you, boy?" Uncle demanded. "I told you we were all going to be down at the dock."
"It slipped my mind, Father." He strolled into the room and picked at the pile of clothes and glanced at the kite. "They forgot one thing," Black Dog said. He reached under his tunic, which went all the way past his waist. He tossed a demon's steel knife onto the table. Father swept it up quickly. "I'll hold this for you till you need it." "He may need it soon," Black Dog said. "The demons are all getting drunk and getting ready for beating up Tong men. The word is out to stay inside." Right then, we all heard the sound of a glass window shattering. Uncle led the way down the steps. The left window had been broken, and the glass lay scattered across the floor. I was closest to the right window when the brick came through it. I stared at the brick as it slid across the clean, worn wooden floor and at the glass that scattered about my feet. Outside, I could hear jeers and shouts. For one moment, I glimpsed howling, sweating, red and white faces, distorted into hideous masks of hatred and cruelty, a sea of demon heads that bobbed restlessly outside our store. I could not understand the words they were growling out, but their intention was plain. They wanted to burn and loot and hurt. Looking into that huge mass of faces was like looking into the ugliest depths of the human soul. By the light of the gas lamps on the street, I could see the company. They all wore the same proud, silent expression. They had all been through this before. The demons called out things in their tongue. Father's face flushed, and he clenched and unclenched his fists. Hand Clap sighed.
"Maybe now they'll get tired of us."
"They usually do," Uncle observed. "They'll go after fresh game now."
He shook his head.
"But these are bad times when one wishes all one's troubles on one's neighbors."
There came the sound of more windows breaking farther on down the street. With more shouts, the demons began to drift away until only a few remained in front of our store. But even these left soon enough. White Deer turned to Father.
"Look at Moonshadow. He's dying to see your room."
"You'll need help boarding up the windows and clearing up this mess," Father said.
Uncle waved his hand.
"No, no, Wind Rider. Show the boy your room."
"Welcome to the land of the demons, boy," Black Dog laughed grimly.
The glass crunched underneath our feet as we walked toward the stairs.